I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Hello again. I'm Warren Olney. Welcome to another To The Point podcast. What it means to be American. That's the title of a project of Socolow Public Square and the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. One American with a lot to say about that was Dr. Martin Luther King. His birthday, of course, we're celebrating this week. In Los Angeles, I recently talked about him with David Garrow. He is the author of Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. His book won the Pulitzer Prize for Biography in 1987 and the 7th Annual Robert F. Kennedy Book Award. Here's our interview. David, it's great to be with you.
Yes, thank you.
Bearing the Cross, the title, it seems to me, in many ways, says it all, because Martin Luther King Jr. really saw his life, certainly at the end of his life, as a kind of sacrificial drama.
Yes. Dr. King, right from the early weeks of the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955-56, saw his role, saw his calling as a personal sacrifice. He had no egotistical desire to be a quote-unquote leader, to be a famous person. He got drafted by the other black civic activists in Montgomery to be the lead spokesperson for the bus boycott, primarily because he was brand new in town and wasn't aligned with any of the existing sort of black civic factions in the city. And all along, throughout the late 50s, throughout the course of the 1960s, Dr. King always thinks of his life and his role in a self-sacrificial way. And bearing the cross is a phrase that he himself used on at least four or five occasions that we have, from audio tape, where he is explicitly or implicitly talking about how he copes with this role that he feels he got dragged into.
He was drafted by other civil rights leaders, but there was also another influence. Tell us about the moment in the kitchen.
Right. About 8 weeks into the Montgomery boycott, late January of 1956, by that time, King has become a known name in Montgomery, thanks to the local news coverage of the boycott. And he started to get a lot of threatening phone calls at the house, the parsonage of his church, Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, 309 South Jackson Street. The house is still there. And King experiences a sort of crisis of faith late one night, sitting at the kitchen table. And several times in later sermons, he spoke very emotionally about really praying to God about what to do at being thrust into this very unpleasant, very dangerous role, a role he didn't want to be in. And it's really important for everyone to understand that King was first and foremost a Baptist minister, that his real grounding was biblical, not Gandhi, not Thoreau. King was through and through a Christian preacher. And so it is that religious faith resource that he turned to that night. And he felt that he was being told that this was the role, this was the obligation that he was being called upon to take up. And whenever in subsequent years he underwent really serious emotional stress again, he would think back to this vision in the kitchen, as Jim Cohn and myself each refer to it, as a source of deep strength.
His father was a minister.
Yes.
He became a minister. Did he at that time really have, you said it was a crisis of faith. Did he doubt his own faith?
He didn't doubt his faith, he doubted his own strength. Doc, as I refer to Dr. King, Doc had made the decision as a very young undergraduate at Morehouse College. Doc finishes his undergraduate education at age 19. He starts college at age 15. And the real formative experience for Dr. King was the 3 years that he went to seminary just outside of Philadelphia, 1948 to 1951, after his undergraduate years at Morehouse College in Atlanta. By the time he gets to Crozer Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania, now he's mature enough to really benefit from the education. That was frankly less true at Morehouse. He then went on to a PhD program in theology at Boston University in Massachusetts. And so by the time of the Montgomery bus boycott, King's only, 26 years old, but he's had, a dozen years of academic training.
He had that crisis of faith that you described. He also, at seminary, overcame his antipathy to white people, which developed because he thought white people had an antipathy to him.
As a young child, a high school student growing up in Atlanta, Atlanta was sufficiently segregated in the 1930s, 1940s, that Dr. King, being from an upper middle class family, had a fairly protected childhood. He only had really three experiences, prior to age 16, of experiencing racial hostility from white people. But at Crozer in seminary, Crozer had a very small student body, but it was at least 30-35% African-American. And it had generally a very good racial tone. And this is, 1948, 1949. There was one segregationist white student there who only lasted a year, Lucius Hall, who threatened King once when a sort of, student prank backfired. But also at Crozer, Dr. King ended up in a very serious romantic relationship with a white woman whose mother was on the staff of the seminary, Betty Moitz. They were very, very attached to each other. But King's closest friends in seminary, Horace Whitaker, his sort of substitute father figure there in Chester, Pennsylvania, Reverend J. Pius Barber, an old friend of Reverend King Sr., they told M.L. Jr. That there's no way you can be a black pastor in the South with a white wife.
One of the things that you talked about a moment ago was the risk and danger of what he ultimately decided that he would do, and I want to talk more about that, but it's interesting that he was raised in a very pampered way. There's simply no other way to describe it.
Right. But Daddy King, Martin Luther King Sr., Daddy King was a very successful pastor who had built Ebenezer Baptist Church into a top church in Atlanta. Not the top church, that was Wheat Street. But Daddy King was not someone of much academic education whatsoever. He'd graduated college, but he was a very different style preacher than Dr. King Jr. came to be. And Daddy King was a very domineering, powerful figure. And so it was very purposeful on Martin Luther Jr.'s part to get away from Atlanta and go to seminary in Pennsylvania, and then to go for his PhD up in Boston. That's a way both of credentialing himself in a way that his father was not, really distinguishing himself from his dad, and also getting away from, you know, still living in the family home when Doc went to Morehouse as an undergrad. He's a day student. I mean, he's commuting across from the, you know, east side of Atlanta to the west side. You know, his collegiate experience, it was he's still living upstairs with mommy and daddy.
So back to the Montgomery experience, you said he was initially, he was new to the area, obviously. He'd been in Atlanta and other places. How much of a shock was it to him when all of a sudden he was, as you indicated, sort of drafted into the civil rights movement?
Dr. King had only been there in Montgomery at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church for about 15 months when the bus boycott got started. Mrs. Rosa Parks, whose arrest kicked off the boycott, she was the secretary of the local NAACP chapter, and she had tried to get Dr. King to be an active participant in that chapter, and he'd begged off, you know, saying he had, you know, too much to do with the church and starting a family. When the boycott gets going, it's really started by other black women in Atlanta, the Women's Political Council. They're the people who actually get it organized, get it started. But those women were all teachers, primarily at Alabama State College, and ergo they were on white-controlled payrolls and vulnerable to economic retaliation. King and other ministers weren't so economically vulnerable. That's why King and his best friend, Ralph Abernathy, end up becoming the public face of the boycott. And people like Joanne Robinson, Mary Fair Burks, stay in the background so as not to lose their teaching jobs.
Ralph Abernathy, of course, has succeeded him as the head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. How did the Southern Leadership Conference come about, and how soon after the Montgomery boycott?
The real initiative for creating SCLC as a Southwide regional organization, playing off of the success of the boycott, the real idea for that was from three New Yorkers. Ella Baker, a longstanding black political activist who'd been a top official at the NAACP, but who didn't like the NAACP's top-down decision-making structure. Byard Rustin, longtime peace activist, very experienced. And then Stanley Levison, a white lawyer from an old left background, who was wealthy enough that he too was a supporter of efforts in the South. And it's really Byard and Miss Baker and Stanley who sell the idea of SCLC to King and Abernathy and other ministers that King and Ralph knew, like Joe Lowry, Fred Shuttlesworth in Mobile and Birmingham, respectfully. But Byard, Rustin, Byard's the one who actually typed up the founding documents for SCLC.
Stanley Levinson became his best friend.
Yes.
In many ways, certainly his best white friend. And that caused him some problems as time went on.
Yes. Stan Levison was an attorney, didn't practice, real estate investor, part owner of a car dealership. But up till 1954, 1955, Levison had secretly been one of the most important financial functionaries in the Communist Party USA. Having grown up out in Far Rockaway, and having known since childhood the fellow who was actually the treasurer of the American Communist Party, William Wiener. Unbeknownst to Levison or any of the Communist Party folks at that time in the mid-50s, the American Party's two international ambassadors, guys who traveled to the Soviet Union, eventually traveled to Red China, were paid FBI informants, Jack and Morris Childs. And so when Levison, having basically left the Communist Party in the mid-50s, when Levison then turns up as an advisor to King, the FBI is rather tardy in discovering this. The FBI's hypothesis in 1962 is essentially, voila, someone who once had been as important as Levison was is now Martin Luther King's top advisor by accident? So that's the beginning of all the electronic surveillance of Leveson, of Bayard Rustin, of other King advisors, eventually of King himself. And King was pressured again and again by the Kennedy administration, by Robert Kennedy's deputies, by President Kennedy himself in 1963, to break ties with Leveson. But King believed that these vague assertions about what Leveson was, that he was a Soviet agent, King thought that was laughable. And so King basically did not take the Kennedy brothers' warnings with any degree of seriousness. And he was frankly less than forthright in what he said to the Kennedys. He keeps in touch with Leveson through an intermediary. Well, the FBI hears about that literally from the telephone taps. And so the Kennedy brothers both develop the perception, thanks to the FBI, that King isn't being honest with them.
So the wiretaps were conducted by the FBI under the supervision of J. Edgar Hoover.
Right.
And Robert Kennedy, who was the Attorney General of the United States, for whom an award that you received was named, ordered them done.
Yes. In the weird legalities of that time, wiretaps required the Attorney General's signature, and Robert Kennedy's signature is on all those papers, but microphone surveillances, bugs in hotel rooms or offices, the FBI did those on its own. The Attorney General wasn't involved in that. And so when the FBI branched out to recording King in various hotel rooms across the country, the Justice Department leadership became aware of that, but they hadn't approved it, and they were often led to believe that these sort of hotel room tapes had actually come from some local police department or state police agency.
How were those tapes used against Martin Luther King?
Dr. King was not monogamous. That's the beginning fact. From 1963 onward, Dr. King had a very serious relationship with a woman, a relationship as important as any in his life. The FBI was aware of that. She was someone very active in the movement. And he also had 8-10 other lady friends in different cities. That's the sort of material that the FBI come 1963, 64 into 65, is obsessed with gathering. And they're sending teams of agents around the country, city to city, trying to be one step ahead of King so that they can get the hotel rooms wired up before King gets there. And it's those sort of hotel bedroom surveillances that the FBI then starts distributing both within the federal government, to Lyndon Johnson, once he becomes president in late 1963, and also surreptitiously sharing with journalists and religious leaders. But in the journalism ethics of the 1960s, nobody, year after year, in the press, either in print media or in broadcast media, ever went public with how the FBI was handing around this sexual material on King. Everyone within elite Washington knew this was happening, but it was never put on the record. So King suffers great emotional turmoil knowing that this is being done to him, but it never emerges as a public issue. Only after King's assassination in 1968, when Robert Kennedy is challenging Johnson and Vice President Hubert Humphrey for who's going to have control of the Democratic nomination in 1968, only then does it happen to leak, no doubt from the FBI, that Robert Kennedy's signature is on all those wiretap authorizations.
So from King's standpoint, this was part of bearing the cross.
Yes.
Why did they do it?
The FBI had a racial paternalism to it. Now, J. Edgar Hoover, by any definition of the word, was a capital R racist. But Hoover's deputies were not hostile to the entire black civil rights movement. It's very important to stress that. The FBI had close working relationships with Roy Wilkins and Thurgood Marshall at the NAACP, with Jim Farmer at the Congress of Racial Equality, with Whitney Young at the National Urban League. The FBI saw King as a dangerous threat, both because of Leveson and this notion of communist influence, and because they insisted they were horror-struck that a minister was sleeping around. They also were very hostile to SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, because the FBI viewed SNCC as also dangerously radical. So the FBI's behavior was wanting to sort of help the civil rights movement be conservative and moderate and protect it from communist influence. All throughout the 50s, 60s, into the 70s, the FBI retained a hugely exaggerated fear of communism long after the U.S. Communist Party, as of 1956 and thereafter, was basically just a husk of an organization.
There was no way that King could have somehow gone public with this material or in some other way figured out how to remove that part of the cross that he was trying to bear.
Correct. He's very aware. His closest aides, Bernard Lee, Andy Young, they're very aware they're being surveilled. All of the transcripts from the taps on Leveson, Bayard Rustin, Clarence Jones, King's lawyer, those we have had for 35 years, since I first got them in 1980, 1981. And sometimes on those wiretaps, they'll make a joke about, you know, be careful what you're saying or you'll end up in J. Edgar Hoover's Golden Records Club. And with the hotel microphone surveillances, the FBI paper trail, reflects that, you know, Bernard Lee and Andy Young and King get to a hotel and they can hear Lee and Young going around the hotel room searching for microphones that they don't find. But for King, for his top aides, the movement was so intense, so nonstop. King is speaking an average of at least once a day, year after year, across the early, mid-1960s. So the intensity of King's daily life is such that he doesn't really have all that much time to be petrified by fear. The FBI hears him on some phone calls when he's emotionally agitated, worried about, is this going to leak into the public? But it's something that more often than not he pushed out of his mind.
So he was drafted into the movement. He conducted himself with the extraordinary intensity that you describe. What were his goals?
As of 1956, the NAACP and Thurgood Marshall had this phrase, free by 63. The Brown versus Board of Education decision come down in 1954. And even at the time of the Montgomery boycott, a year and a half, 2 years later, the attitude within the leadership of black civil rights organizations was that beating down legal segregation, legalized discrimination, was going to happen fairly quickly given this powerful Supreme Court precedent. Well, they didn't quite make it by 63, but when the 1964 Civil Rights Act outlaws all racial discrimination in public accommodations, and then the 1965 Voting Rights Act outlaws racially discriminatory voting practices, from the vantage point of 1955, 1956, the 64 and 65 acts were what everybody had been dreaming of a decade earlier. But by the time the 1965 statute is signed into law by President Johnson in the summer of 65, King and most everyone else in the movement have come to realize that they had been incredibly, naively optimistic about what curing American racism would involve. Back in the 50s, people thought that Supreme Court decisions, passing federal statutes, That was the goal. That was the solution. But by a decade later, everyone realizes that simply outlawing discrimination at lunch counters and in motels or on voter registration rolls.
Or in schools.
Or in schools, exactly. That's not doing anything with regard to the economic privation that most black Americans were suffering from. So Dr. King, by 1965, 1966, has essentially seen the horizon recede away from him at a pretty dramatic degree. And he's thinking about, okay, what do we have to do to tackle housing discrimination, employment discrimination, all sorts of particularly urban racial practices, and the economic privation of black America. King and his top aides make the decision after that voting rights victory in Selma to go north to Chicago. And there's a big effort in 1966, the Chicago Freedom Movement, which ends up focusing primarily on how incredibly discriminatory urban housing markets are. And they win a symbolic victory from the powers that be in Chicago. But that success didn't even really begin to touch the surface of just how pervasive rip-off real estate practices were in targeting black people in a city like Chicago.
You mentioned earlier the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Stokely Carmichael being the principal leader. How did Dr. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference get along with SNCC and with the other civil rights organizations?
SNCC initially comes out of the student sit-in movement in the spring of 1960. By 1961, early 62, SNCC is sending young field secretaries, black college students, recent graduates, out to do local organizing in really difficult, hellacious, rural counties in southwest Georgia, in southwest Mississippi, in the Mississippi Delta. And from 1962 through 1965, SNCC is really the leading edge, cutting edge of the Southern movement, again and again.
Ahead of the Southern Christian Leadership
Conference. More so, yes. And SNCC is doing not big demonstrations and marches in a Birmingham or a Selma. They're doing local community organizing. SNCC makes a big effort in Mississippi in 1964, but then gets turned away when they try to go to the 1964 Democratic National Convention because Lyndon Johnson thinks that sort of an embrace of SNCC in Mississippi might fatally harm his reelection possibilities. Up through 1965, SNCC is very much in close tandem with Dr. King and SCLC's emphasis on nonviolent resistance. Only in 1966, when Stokely Carmichael succeeds John Lewis, now Congressman John Lewis, as SNCC's chairman, does SNCC turn towards the rhetorical phrase black power. And for much of 1966 and 1967, there's a huge media controversy over what does black power mean. And Carmichael is an intentional, rhetorical bomb thrower. He never quite wants to specify what does black power mean. He wants it to mean different things to different people. And King is very much torn and pulled and twisted. King doesn't want to denounce black power, but he also wants to make crystal clear that there's nothing anti-white about it. This goes on for months.
For what it's worth, in 1968, I covered a news conference with Stokely Carmichael. This was after Martin Luther King had been assassinated, but we were brought in, we the press, with our television cameras and so on, and there were all these guys around the room who had pistols. And they brandished them, and they made sure that we saw them, and we all took pictures of them, and they were being very aggressive. Was nonviolence controversial within
the movement?
Nonviolence is not controversial, certainly up through 1964. But in rural Mississippi, in rural Louisiana, most black farmers had guns. The first organized self-defense efforts really come from a Louisiana, northern Louisiana group called the Deacons for Defense and Justice. They start showing up at protests in 1966 for defensive purposes. Prior to that, there was only fringe issues of Negroes with guns, a title of a book from that time. But King's own grounding in nonviolence was just total, deep ethical, religious commitment on his part. At two different times, in 1963 and again in 1965, King is literally punched by Nazis, once in Birmingham, once in Selma. And not only does King not punch back, but no one else punches these guys. They're taken away. And that was the ethic of how King lived his life. King made a very explicit emphasis on never let anyone drag you so low as to hate them. Hate destroys the hater. King always distinguished between the evil deed and the evil doer. So for King, even with someone like Lester Maddox, who becomes the segregationist governor of Georgia in 1966, or George Wallace in Alabama, King was totally clear in his own mind that he would never allow himself to hate these men. His ethic of Christian love always taught him that these people could be saved from their racism. He was always optimistic about converting people to the cause of human equality. And so King had a strength of spirit that, to put it politely, I just don't think we see much at all of in this country 50, 55 years later.
Was he able to convert anybody?
There are some instances of that, not particularly well known. There are literally some instances of Klan members who come to realize that their own racial hatred is wrong and do convert. Hmm. But it's less a utilitarian hope on King's part than it is a faith grounding.
What about the extraordinary speech on the Lincoln Memorial? How important was that to King? What role did he see himself playing at that point? And what role did he play? How significant was that moment?
The "I Have a Dream" phrase and speech was one that King had previously given at least twice that we know of. King almost always spoke and preached extemporaneously, not reading a text. He had in his head this huge archive or library of biblical stories, quotations, and he would start with a theme. He'd have a clear idea of what he wanted to do. But when he's speaking, he's doing it off the cuff. And so in Washington that day at the march, for that there actually was an advance text, because the organizers of the march had made everybody submit an advance text for approval. John Lewis's SNCC speech was thought to be too radical, and there ends up being a lot of arm wrestling about how Lewis's speech gets censored and toned down. But King's actual speech, the first two-thirds or three-quarters of it, was roughly from text. But the famous parts of it are all extemporaneously added on and go line for line, like previous versions that King had given in Rocky Mount, North Carolina about a year earlier and in Detroit, Michigan about 2 months earlier. To people today who listen to that speech or read the words from it, the King of that speech is a much more upbeat, optimistic political voice than the King of the ensuing 5 years, from the fall of 1963 up till his assassination in 68. So, to me as a historian, that speech is unrepresentative and can be misleading, because it can mislead people from failing to understand what a very tough critic of American inequality, and what a very outspoken critic of American militarism around the world King becomes in the last 3 or 4 years of his life, particularly with regard to the war in Vietnam.
Yeah, very definitely, he was opposed to that. So did he then get depressed? Did he conclude that the goals that he had set out to achieve were in fact unachievable?
By the end of his life, Dr. King is very pessimistic about America's future. He's exhausted, he's just really drained, often depressed, both because of how little progress and achievement he and others have been able to make in targeting economic inequality from 66 to 68. But he's also very unhappy, very depressed about how the war in Vietnam has expanded and grown, and anti-war protests have had very little impact on the Johnson administration.
Did that change his view about nonviolence at all?
No. No. King believed in nonviolence in the international realm as well as in a domestic protest context. When King received the 1964 Nobel Peace Prize, as a sort of symbol of the American black freedom struggle, King took that award as excessive individual praise of himself, and as a result felt he had to try even harder to do even more. So the Peace Prize increases King's sense of burden and directly leads him to think that now I've got to really speak prophetically about violence in the world, not just about violence in the American South.
We've talked about a number of people in the, or you have mentioned a number of people in the civil rights movement, Stokely Carmichael, Thurgood Marshall, Bayard Rustin. Were you able to talk to any of those people about Dr. King, and what did the most interesting ones and surprising ones have to say about him?
I first started driving around the South, interviewing people who'd worked with Dr. King, in September of 1979. And so most people were still alive then. Yeah. When I first went to Montgomery, Mr. E.D. Nixon, Mr. Rufus Lewis, two competing factotums of black Montgomery were still there. Mrs. Joanne Robinson, who more than anyone was responsible for the bus boycott. By the early 1980s, she's living here in Los Angeles. She was run out of Montgomery in her teaching job there a few years after the boycott, and she ended up teaching high school here in Los Angeles for years. So I was very fortunate to come along so early that 95% or more of the people that had worked with Dr. King knew him super well. Bernard Lee, Bill Rutherford were still alive. And it gave me a tremendous grounding. It really initiated me into the real meaning of the movement in a way that I, as a sort of 26-year-old white boy, had not previously really understood.
Did you talk later to those who were also well-known figures in the civil rights movement about him? Were you able to get to them? Were you able to get to Robert Kennedy before he was killed?
No, I'm way too young.
Much too young for
RFK.
Yeah. Well, that's right. You said 79. Of course, 68 was when he was assassinated, too. So were you able to talk to any of the great figures that still were alive?
Let me take that question in a slightly different direction. I also went out of my way to talk with all of King's most direct and dangerous opponents. Mm-hmm. Policemen in Montgomery, Sheriff Lori Pritchett from Albany, Georgia, mm-hmm. Sheriff Jim Clark from mm-hmm. Selma. By the time I found Jim Clark, he was selling mobile homes in Scottsboro, Alabama, a location that people who know older American racial history will yeah. find ironic. J.B. Stoner, who was the organizer of terror bombings in the South in the 1950s and 60s. Stoner was head of a group called the National States Rights Party, Nazis. And they bombed Jewish temples as well as black churches.
What did they think of King?
Oh, they loathed King. But This is a very good story to tell. The FBI went after Stoner just as forcefully as they went after King. So Stoner, this Southern Nazi who had all sorts of personal problems, I'll say in this sort of a context, Stoner hated J. Edgar Hoover because the FBI had gone after he and gone after other similar Klan-type organizations very forcefully. All the dirty tricks that the FBI later used against black radicals, student radicals, had previously used against American communists, they also used those exact same dirty tricks against white Southern Klansmen.
Wow. King, you indicated, became somewhat depressed late in his life. And we began by talking about the title of your book, which is Bearing the Cross. Would it be wrong to say that, given that he saw himself as sacrificing his life for the cause, he wouldn't have been surprised by his own assassination?
Oh, no, not at all. Doc knew from very early in his civil rights career that he would be killed. He's always aware of that from 1956 forward. And he wasn't in any way obsessed with it. It's a completely rational perception. He several times said to people, yes, this ends with me getting killed.
What do you think is the ultimate legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
King's answer to that question would be how much he failed to accomplish. That economic equality for black America remains almost as unachieved 50 years later as it was in 1968. He would similarly say that with regard to American military practices, policies, imperialism, a word he would use, in the world, America's international footprint remains hugely different from what he wished for. But I think he would be most disappointed, unhappy, upset by how the spirit of nonviolence has vanished from American life, on the left as well as on the right.
This is fascinating. I think we're almost out of time. I got a signal a moment ago, but you wrote this book some time ago, and I'm interested in whether, since you completed the book, you've changed your views at all, or that you see things in a different way, particularly as far as King's contribution to the history of the country is concerned.
By 1986, when Bearing the Cross came out, you know, we had 25-plus years in time then from the high point of the movement. No, my fundamental attitude today is not particularly different at all than it was, say, 30 years ago. We have a better appreciation now of how important SNCC was, and I think it's crucial for people to realize, especially younger people, that the civil rights movement was not somehow commanded by Dr. King. King very much understood that he was a symbolic leader, not a commander. And again, the lesson that the black freedom struggle in the South in the 60s should give us is that local people, like in Montgomery, like in Birmingham, local people can take the initiative successfully for themselves. They don't have to wait for a great man or a great person to come along and lead or instruct them.
Hypothetical questions always seem to be unfair, but I can't help asking you one. If his biggest regret would be the lack of the spirit of nonviolence, what would he try to do about it?
He would be preaching very forcefully that if a Nazi punches you, the correct progressive political response is not punch a Nazi. King would be denouncing anti-fa at least as forcefully as he'd be denouncing white nationalists. It's crucial for people of color, for people on the left, to realize that that's the truth and the spirit of Martin Luther King, not some racial or political partisanship.
Did Jim Lawson help him learn about nonviolence? Was he an important figure?
Jim Lawson is a notable figure in civil rights history on his own stance. By the time Lawson and King really start working together, some in 1960, Dr. King's own grounding is really firm. Ironically, painfully, you know, Lawson's largest role is he's the person who convinces King to come to Memphis in 1968, because the sanitation strike there, which Lawson was very important in supporting, the sanitation strike there in Memphis was the perfect cause and opportunity that King wanted at that time.
And that's, of course, where he was assassinated, during which he was assassinated. Are you satisfied that justice has been done in that regard? Do we really know who did it?
Yes. Without any imaginable, rational question, James Earl Ray killed Martin Luther King, period. No FBI involvement, no CIA involvement. We do not know, we never will be able to know, whether Ray, small-time racist ex-con, believed by word of mouth that he would be financially rewarded by segregationist businessmen for having done this. It's highly likely that Ray had heard there was money out there to be earned. But even when this was first really investigated in 1976, 1977, 40 years ago now, too many people had already died in the ensuing 10 years for that to be discoverable. The FBI failed badly in 1968 in looking for that sort of a conspiracy contemporaneously. But there is no government involvement, notwithstanding how many deranged, unreliable people would still say that today.
You say the FBI failed, though. Were there then conspiracies to destroy Martin Luther King that were going but which weren't successful, and did James Earl Ray do the work for them?
The Bureau had very much wanted King to be removed from civil rights leadership. They wanted someone more moderate. They actually, Bill Sullivan, the head of the FBI's Domestic Intelligence Division, actually had a black lawyer from New York, Sam Pierce, who later ends up in Ronald Reagan's cabinet. Sam Pierce was Sullivan's sort of pet person to become a civil rights figure. But the Bureau was in no way complicit with racial assassinations. No.
It's interesting you should mention Ronald Reagan, because even Ronald Reagan once or twice mentioned the possibility, or perhaps, I forget how he phrased it, but that King might have been a commie, might have had an association with the Communist Party.
Even in 1983, when the King Federal Holiday Bill is signed into law by President Reagan, you still had right-wing segregationist members of Congress who were still fixated on the FBI's old communism hypothesis about Stanley Levison. But Levison was wiretapped and bugged, coming and going, from 1962 until after King's death, and all of that electronic surveillance never produced one scintilla of evidence that Levison was anything other than an honest supporter of King and civil rights. There are thousands of pages of telephone wiretap logs on Levison, you know, calling the dry cleaners, ordering pizza, talking to his brother. Stanley Levison was innocent of in any way manipulating Martin Luther King for subversive ends.
But nobody told Ronald Reagan.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was great. Once again, I spoke with David Garrow as part of What It Means to Be American. That's a project of Socolow Public Square and the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. I'm Orman Olney. Our To The Point podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, other podcast forums, and kcrw.com/To The Point.
Nobody knows the trouble I see.